headlines. Millions of Muslims from across the globe are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate Arba'een. Pyongyang says it has staged what it calls a simulated tactical nuclear attack drill in response to joint military war games by the U.S. and South Korea. And Ukraine reports a drone strike on the southern Odessa region days after a major drone attack on a Russian airport in Pskov region. Warm welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. It's good to have you with us. Millions of Muslims from across the globe are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate Arba'een, the 40th day after the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam, and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life are marching toward the holy city, most notably from Iran. Senior Iranian government officials have made multiple visits to the border crossings in recent days to ensure a smooth passage for pilgrims to and from Iraq. Experts say that it is significant to keep alive the movement of Karbala, which is a movement against terrorism, fascism, and despotism. Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD, while fighting courageously for justice against the much larger army of then-tyrant ruler Yazid. Demonstrations in the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk over the handover of a key facility from federal to local Kurdish authorities have turned violent. Police say at least three protesters have been shot dead and 14 have been injured. Police have launched an investigation to determine who opened fire. Kurdish supporters, Arab and Turkmen protesters, as well as security forces were all involved in the clashes. The Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has ordered a curfew in the city, promising justice. The Iraqi President Abdul Latif Rashid has also called for constructive dialogue. The Iraqi army has been using the Kurdistan Democratic Party headquarters in Kirkuk as a base since federal forces seized the city and the surrounding oil fields in 2017. However, the government now wants to return the building to a KDP in a show of goodwill. Kirkuk has historically been disputed between the federal government in Baghdad and authorities in the semi-autonomous Kurdish region in the north. Fresh details have emerged from a major Israeli sabotage attempt against Iran's defense industries that was thwarted by the country's intelligence. Military officials say that a professional team led by Mossad was trying to equip missile connectors with explosive circuits, which could then be programmed to blow up at a specific time.
It's a plot out of a Hollywood movie, but with serious repercussions. The shadow war between Israel and Iran. This one involves an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including missiles, the biggest military sabotage attempt against Iran in the past 100 years. It is one that failed, however, just in the nick of time. The agency's statement reveals the scope of the operation. The intelligence unit of the Defense Ministry thwarted one of the largest sabotage plots targeting Iran's missile, aviation, and aerospace military industry. This sabotage was carried out under the guidance of the Zionist intelligence services and their agents. A network of agents sought to introduce defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connectors from abroad. The defective parts were discovered by the Defense Ministry Information Protection. The plan was to equip these connectors with explosive circuits. If that was done successfully, the connectors could be programmed to explode remotely at any time.
The Israeli spy agency Mossad has been at the heart of anti-Iran plots for decades. Simply put, it has targeted Iran in order to stop its advancements in a variety of fields. But apparently what has been of interest is Iran's nuclear program and Iran's defense industry. This includes targeting scientists and nuclear facilities.
Under the false pretext of preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Mossad has been carrying out a campaign of sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's civilian nuclear program for quite some time. One of the notorious ones was the Stuxnet virus. In April 2011, Iranian government official Ghulam Reza Jalali stated that an investigation had concluded that both the United States and Israel were behind the Stuxnet attack. Mossad has also methodically assassinated and murdered Iranian nuclear scientists, from magnetic bombs attached to the side of their cars, to the use of poison, and allegedly the use of a killer robot remotely used as an assassin. Additionally, Israel has also targeted Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel's targeting of Iran's defense industry, in particular its drones and missile program, does make sense from Israel's point of view. Iran has made extraordinary advancements in these two fields and military hardware overall. But all of these destructive actions, which Israel has not claimed responsibility for, has not been able to stop Iran's advancement. From Israel's perspective, it makes strategic sense, though only a temporary fix. There's an Iranian saying that says, "Don't play with the lion's tail." Iran may have thwarted these acts of sabotage, but for how long will its patience last when it comes to Israel?
Israeli settlers have once again stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under the protection of regime forces. According to Palestinian media, the settlers toured the compound and performed rituals there. Under an agreement reached between Jordan and the Israeli regime in 1967, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited. Al-Aqsa Mosque is subjected to almost daily incursions by Israeli settlers, which provoke Palestinians' anger. On Friday, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned that any incursions during the Jewish holiday is tantamount to an all-out war. Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets of Tel Aviv for the 35th consecutive week to protest against what they call a judicial coup.
I came out here today with my family so that we can protest against the judicial coup. It's a crucial time right now. We need to come out. We need to be in the streets. We have a big vote in about 2 weeks, and I can't tell you that I'm hopeful, but we are not going to stop coming out until we're able to turn back and make sure that everyone has someone else watching over what they're doing. Nobody has the power to make changes at their whim.
Mass protests against the so-called judicial overhaul have been ongoing since it was proposed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet back in January. In August, Israel's Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the overhaul, which set off an unprecedented domestic crisis. Israel is now facing public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of its military. The opposition believes that the cabinet is aiming to weaken the judiciary and to prevent it from being able to maintain checks and balances on the cabinet. They say that the protests will continue until they are able to repeal the legislation. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea confirms it staged a, quote, simulated tactical nuclear attack drill during the weekend with mock atomic warheads attached to two long-range cruise missiles. The missiles were fired from the country's west coast toward the Yellow Sea. Pyongyang said the operation on Saturday was a counteraction drill in response to the joint military activity by the U.S. and South Korea. The launches come 3 days after the DPRK fired a pair of short-range ballistic missiles as part of a similar drill. This comes as Seoul and Washington have ramped up their joint military exercises with advanced stealth jets and U.S. strategic assets. Pyongyang says the U.S. and the South are pursuing, quote, confrontation hysteria, adding that it views such war games as a rehearsal for invasion. Washington and Seoul claim that they are defensive in nature. The correspondent Frank Smith says the U.S.-backed U.N. sanctions against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are impediments to Washington's engagement with Pyongyang.
The U.S. always says it's open to negotiations, but really the big elephant in the room for the United States, of course, is the U.S.-supported United Nations Security Council sanctions against North Korea that prevent North Korea from trading with the international community. North Korea has said on many occasions that it will negotiate with the U.S. if it drops its hostile policy. It views the promotion and continued sanctions against North Korea as hostile. It prevents North Korea from developing its economy and has some other consequences that go far beyond the sort of goals of those sanctions to make it difficult for North Korea, for example, to grow its own food. If it doesn't have access to oil, it doesn't have the drivers in the economy that fuel tractors, for example. So it has a whole knock-on effect that strike the North Korean people and not necessarily the leadership. So again, it's these United Nations Security Council sanctions that U.S. might have to, and certainly the council should look at, suspending in order to encourage North Korea to come to the negotiating table, draw down the tension, and really put things on another foot moving forward.
Now to Taiwan, domestic flights and ferry services to surrounding islands have been canceled as Typhoon Haiku makes landfall on eastern Taiwan. The Civil Aeronautics Administration says 37 international flights have also been canceled for Sunday. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing says this is the first typhoon to make landfall on the island and cross the central mountain range in 4 years. Almost 3,000 people have been evacuated, mainly in the south and east. The military has mobilized soldiers and equipment to help with flood relief and evacuation efforts. Ukraine says its southern Odessa region came under attack by over 24 drones early on Sunday. Ukraine's South Military Command says the attacks targeted the civil infrastructure in a port on the Danube River. The military says the attacks left 2 people injured and caused a fire in the port area. The military did not specify which port was hit, but Ukrainian media reported blasts in the Reni port. Russia has yet to comment. This comes days after Ukraine said a major drone attack on a Russian airport in the Pskov region destroyed 2 transport planes and seriously damaged 2 others. Ukraine has vowed to return the conflict to Russia, and in recent weeks, it has increased drone attacks on Russian territory, including the capital Moscow. Russia has been responding with its own drone strikes on the Ukrainian capital Kiev and other cities. Hundreds of people in Belgrade have staged a rally against the government of Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić. Protesters chanting for the removal of Vučić marched through the city and assembled in front of the parliament. They condemned violence and alleged political corruption in Serbia. Protest organizers also demand the dismissal of several officials. Protests in Belgrade and throughout Serbia began after 2 deadly mass shootings in the country in May and carried on during the summer. Furious, rail unions in Italy have staged a national strike after 5 workers were run over by a train earlier this week. Safety in the workplace has now turned into an issue of growing concern in the country. More on this report from Rome.
On Friday, trade and base unions held a nationwide strike over what they call a shameful number of deaths at work. On Wednesday, 5 maintenance workers were hit by a train while repairing tracks on the Milan-Turin line in northern Italy. The day after, 2 more workplace fatalities occurred, bringing the total number of deaths on the job to over 700 since January. Unions are saying these tragedies could have been avoided.
Yes, these deaths could have been prevented. As safety in the workplace costs money, companies prefer to save on worker safety this way, making bigger profits. Our railway system was in the hands of the state until not long ago. Today, most of it has been contracted to private firms. Private groups only know how to offer services at the cheapest rate. It's like a rat race. If workers complain about their working conditions, they are fired.
On Friday, prosecutors placed under investigation an employee of the National Rail Company, RFI, in relation to the accident in which 5 maintenance workers were hit and killed by a train. Safety in the workplace is an issue of increasing concern in Italy. According to the European Union's statistical agency Eurostat, 776 fatal accidents on the job were recorded in Italy in 2020. By far the highest number in the bloc.
On top of the deaths at work, we also have a high number of non-fatal accidents and practically no protection for workers on very demanding physically and psychologically jobs. Private companies must be given strict rules when doing workplace safety risk assessments, and their managers have to be severely punished when they fail to observe these rules.
Unions are demanding that the workplace safety issue seriously enter the political debate and that the country's work system finally comply with the EU safety standards. Max Civili, Rome.
One day after Niger's military rulers accused France of blatant interference in the country's affairs, thousands of people in the capital, Niamey, have held an anti-French rally. Protesters demanded the former colonial ruler withdraw his military personnel from the West African nation. Iranians are marking the National Day of the Fight Against British Colonialism, commemorating the 109th anniversary of the martyrdom of Rais Ali Delbari, a great national hero and independence fighter who led the anti-colonial struggle in southern Iran. However, this year the occasion is even more special, as many Iranians have had the chance to mark this day where he has been laid to rest.
And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Reasons behind enemies targeting Islam is the political rules of Islam. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and Officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps on August 17, 2023 in the Imam Khomeini's Hosseiniyeh. Today, the IRGC is the largest counter-terrorism organization in all the world. It is a well-equipped military organization. It is an efficient, independent organization that is capable of doing things that many of the world's greatest armies are incapable of doing. So this was about the growth and expansion of the IRGC. Another point is related to the IRGC's performance. This is also an appealing, multifaceted phenomenon. First of all, one of the most important things that the IRGC has done from day one and is continuing up until today is that it deals with this crisis created by the enemy. This is very important. Let me tell you about a historical event. A short time, about 1 month before the history of revolution, in the early days of January 1979 to be exact, the head of four countries, the United States, England, France, and Germany, conducted a conference, or in their own words, a gathering on a French island called Guadeloupe, which later became known as a Guadeloupe Conference.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The topic of discussion in this conference was the revolution, Iran's revolution. The Islamic Revolution. They gathered together there to talk about what they should do in response to this revolution. They could see that the revolution was about to become victorious. They came to the conclusion that was impossible to save Pahlavi puppet regime. That was the first conclusion that was drawn in the Guadeloupe Conference. They said that it's impossible. We can't do it. The second outcome was that they comforted themselves by saying that, yes, this revolution will be victorious, but it will face crises and none of the governments that come to power after the revolution will be able to overcome those crises. This is what was stated in the published documents from this conference. They came to this conclusion. This is the amount that was set from this conference. They said that any government that comes to office after revolution will collapse because of the crisis and it will not be able to continue.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russia has warned that the West's approval of Ukraine's attacks on Crimea could set the stage for a disastrous war between Moscow and Kiev's Western allies. The warning has been issued by the deputy chairman of Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. The former Russian president has warned any green light to Ukraine's attacks on Crimea entitles Moscow to take action against, quote, each and every NATO member. He added that such an approval would be considered direct legal evidence of the West's complicity in the war against Russia. Medvedev's comments came after a senior Ukrainian official said Washington supports strikes on Crimea if Kiev deems them necessary. Mikhail Podolyak, senior advisor to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, has also said there is absolute consensus amongst Western countries that Kiev can destroy anything that belongs to Russia in territories taken by Moscow. Medvedev has repeatedly warned Kiev that Moscow would have to use a nuclear weapon if Ukrainian forces set foot on Russian territory. Medvedev has said if the West truly supports what Mikhail Podolyak says, it would signal an apocalyptic risk of the end of the world. Moscow has said that the collective West is waging a proxy war against the Russian nation, with the Ukrainian troops under Kiev's command merely providing the cannon fodder for the conflict.
Here you have one country which has 100 million more people than the other country and has much deeper military industrial capacity, can make more missiles, make more bullets, make more tanks than the other country. So over time, the bigger country is almost certain to win, correct? This is a physics principle. Right. It's not a statement of allegiance. You're not a shill for somebody for acknowledging that. If we're wrestling and you outweigh me by 100 pounds, you're probably going to win because you're bigger. That's a fact.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is working to reach a deal with Ukraine for long-term military support to keep backing the war with Russia. According to media reports, the commitments would make it difficult for a future president to exit. The effort is part of a commitment made by G7 nations at the recent NATO summit in Vilnius to negotiate their own bilateral security deals with Ukraine. Besides the G7 nations, 18 other countries have agreed to provide long-term military support for Kiev.
The United States, NATO, and the EU are on the wrong path. And at the very most, it could lead to their destruction. And at the very least, it will destroy the euro, it will destroy the dollar, it will destroy the Western economy.
Reports say Western officials are looking for ways to lock in pledges of support and limit future governments' abilities to backtrack, amid fears in European capitals that Donald Trump, if he recaptures the White House, will seek to scale back the aid. The United States has announced $250 million in fresh military aid to Ukraine. The package is said to include equipment for clearing mines and obstacles, as well as missiles, artillery rounds, anti-armor missiles, and more than 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition. Kiev has already received more than $43 billion from the U.S. in the form of weapon systems like howitzers and millions of rounds of ammunition, including widely banned cluster munitions since last February when Russia started a special military operation in Ukraine. The flow of arms to Ukraine has raised concerns in some European capitals. Former Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte has said NATO's strategy regarding the conflict in Ukraine has not led to the outcome desired by the alliance, and the economic sanctions imposed on Russia have not crippled its economy. According to Conte, the strategy pursued so far in NATO, based on constant military supplies to Ukraine and the logic of escalation, did not lead to a military defeat for Russia. The US and its allies have pledged to give Ukraine F-16 fighter jets, but military experts now believe jets are not going to be a silver bullet for Kiev.
A group of rebellious military officers declared a coup in the Central African nation of Gabon, minutes after the results of the presidential election showed that President Ali Bongo had won a third term. Gabonese junta pushers declared their intention on television on Wednesday, saying that they have overthrown the government of President Ali Bongo. Spokesman for the group denounced the, quote, irresponsible, unpredictable governance of President Ali Bongo, claiming his 14 years in office had resulted in a deterioration in social cohesion that risked leading the country into chaos. President Bongo first took office in 2009, after the death of his father, Omar Bongo, who had become president in 1967.
On this day, August 30th, 2023, we, Defense and Security Forces, meeting within the Committee for the Transition and Restoration of Institutions on behalf of the Gabonese people and guarantor of the protection of institutions, have decided to defend peace by putting an end to the current regime. The general elections of August 26, as well as the truncated results, are cancelled. The borders are closed until further notice. All institutions of the Republic are dissolved.
The latest elections were overshadowed by a lack of international observers, raising concerns about transparency. After the elections, the government curtailed internet service and imposed a nightly curfew across the nation, saying that it was necessary to prevent the spread of misinformation.
The election was perceived as not very transparent. There were no observers, as far as one can tell, international observers or regional, major regional observation mission or anything like that. And the election results were announced in the middle of the night at just around dawn or 3-4 o'clock in the morning.
Gabon is one of the richest countries in Africa in terms of GDP per capita, thanks largely to oil revenues and a small population of 2.3 million. But a third of the population still lives below the poverty line of $5.50 per day. The Central African nation of Gabon shares borders with Cameroon, the Republic of Congo, and Equatorial Guinea. It was a colony of France before gaining independence in 1960. Following the coup, crowds took to the streets of the capital Libreville and Port-Gentil, second largest city, to celebrate the end of Bongo's reign. They also chanted slogans against France. Opponents say the Bongo family has done almost nothing to share the state's oil and mining wealth with the people during its more than half a century in charge of Gabon.
A growing sense of general impatience, as in many African countries, among younger people, urban populations, feeling that it was time for a change, that traditional elites need to move on, and the people feeling that although they had the freedom of speech in Gabon, they couldn't actually choose their leaders.
This is while France, Gabon's former colonial ruler, has condemned the military coup in the African country. France has around 400 soldiers permanently deployed to Gabon for training and military support, including a base in the capital Libreville, and has extensive economic relations with the African country in the mining and oil sectors. Gabon is the second former French colony in Africa to have faced a military coup in as many months, and the sixth in 3 years, following the coups in Mali, Chad, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and most recently Niger, whose new installed junta may yet meet with an intervention from the country's West African neighbors.
What's happening now is in several countries at the same time, sometimes even three neighboring countries, which is the case in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, where there's been a major pullback. And if it happens everywhere at the same time, that's very bad news for the French authorities, because there's this idea of what the authorities call contagion, or at least of examples, giving ideas to others, obviously. In the same way that in 2011, when people in the streets overthrew the dictatorships in Tunisia and Egypt, it gave ideas to neighboring countries. So the same thing could happen. But we'll have to wait and see.
In all of these cases, the former colonizer has been called to play a role of one kind or another, and the question of his influence in each country has been a major one. French mining company Eramet is Gabon's second largest private employer. It has announced that given the current unrest, it is suspending its operations. France had thousands of troops in Mali, where it led a nearly decade-long military operation to combat an insurgency. That operation ended in 2022, after the rise of a military junta there. Throughout the region, France is viewed as a colonial power, which many blame it for the widespread instability there.
Tensions between Niamey and Paris are running high as Niger's military leaders have given the French ambassadors 48 hours to leave the country. In a statement, Niger's foreign minister said the decision to expel the French ambassador was taken partly due to their refusal to respond to an invitation to a meeting with Niger's Minister of Foreign Affairs. The statement added that actions by the French government have been contrary to the interests of the African nation. This prompted a response from France. Paris dismissed the ultimatum, saying Niger's junta have no authority to ask its ambassador to leave. The ultimatum was widely supported by Niger's public. Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the French military base in Niamey on Friday, calling for the departure of foreign troops.
It's all part of the general mobilization we have here. It's to demand the departure of these invading forces, this occupying force, the French force here at Niamey Air Base. That's why we want to come to the door of this base to ask them to leave our country from here. We don't need this occupying force. We don't want them on our land.
The latest development in Niger comes amid a series of anti-French demonstrations in the African country after the army overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum in July. The military leaders in Niamey accused former colonial power France of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. They also said the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is an organization in the pocket of France. This is because ECOWAS has imposed tough economic sanctions on Niger following the coup and has threatened the country with military intervention.
The region is employing other elements of its instruments and engaging with the military authorities. We are hopeful that these diplomatic efforts will yield the desired outcome and make it unnecessary for the deployment of the force. Nonetheless, Preparations continue towards making the force ready for deployment.
The anger and resentment against ECOWAS and its threats to use military force against junta leaders in Niger comes as many across the Sahelian nation blame France for pushing the West African bloc to use military force in Niger. But the question indeed is that where is all that hatred against France coming from? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid the worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is according to UN figures considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public there points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all those grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across the sub-region, but reverberated across Europe and the United States. That's mainly due to the fact that Niger is home to strategic mineral reserves such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the US. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate will be waiting for many across the Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France and the United States, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they're the ones who should put an end to decades of West occupation and economic exploitation of their countries. The United States, and yet another example of racial discrimination. On Saturday, a white man, later identified as 21-year-old Ryan Christopher Perlmutter, went on a shooting rampage, killing three people in the U.S. city of Jacksonville, Florida. Authorities said all the three victims were black, calling the incident racially motivated.
Plainly put, this shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. He wanted to kill niggers. That's the one and only time I'll use that word.
The Jacksonville sheriff said the gunman had authored several manifestos for media, his parents, and law enforcement, detailing his hatred for black people. The sheriff said he also left a will and a suicide note that were retrieved by his father. Police also said the guns used in Jacksonville's shooting were obtained legally.
They were 100% legal, and as I stand here with you today, they were legally possessed. There was nothing indicating, again, like I said, it appears that the dealers that sold those guns to him did it legally. They did what they were supposed to have done.
The Saturday shooting in Jacksonville drew a slew of reactions.
This is a community that has suffered again and again. So many times, this is where we end up. And there were so many people out today, obviously grieving, upset. It's just something that should not and must not continue to happen in our community. It's too often the same folks. We must do everything that we can. We must do everything that we can to dissuade this type of hate.
In a statement, U.S. President Joe Biden said we must refuse to live in a country where black families going to the store or black students going to school live in fear of being gunned down because of the color of their skin. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the Justice Department is investigating the shooting as a hate crime, calling the incident an act of racially motivated violent extremism. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called Jacksonville shooter's comeback.
Florida, the state, and its people condemn the horrific racially motivated murders perpetrated by a deranged scumbag in Jacksonville at the Dollar General store. Perpetrating violence of this kind is unacceptable, and targeting people due to their race has no place in the state of Florida.
The Jacksonville shooting coincides with a rally held in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C., to mark the 60th anniversary of a march at which late prominent civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. gave a galvanizing speech about justice and equality. Thousands of people gathered at the Lincoln Memorial to advocate for racial equality. Speakers at the rally strongly condemned gun violence against black individuals as the crowd chanted Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
The protesters stressed that racism is becoming more prevalent in American society. They highlighted the need for more efforts to eliminate racial discrimination. The 1963 march was a pivotal event in the U.S. civil rights movement at which Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. The march brought more than 250,000 people to the nation's capital to push for an end to discrimination. Yet 60 years on, brutality against black people is happening at record numbers.
Because I'm very concerned about the direction our country is going in. And it is because instead of moving forward, it feels as if we're moving backward.
Just to make that evident, 21 African Americans were killed by U.S. law enforcement officers only in January this year. That already makes the year one of the deadliest ever so far for the African American community in the U.S. That includes the tragic death of Keenan Darden Anderson, who was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident. But that's only one incident of brutality and racial discrimination against blacks. The United States has a long history of such bias against the people of color. One major example was the brutal killing of 46-year-old black man named George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of the handcuffed black man triggered months of mass protests not only in cities across the U.S., but also other parts of the world. With many arguing that America was built on slavery, it is not erroneous to claim that racial profiling against African Americans and other people of color is deeply rooted in American culture. Maybe that's why it is early to think that putting an end to prejudice and racism in the U.S. does not seem to be happening anytime soon.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salaamu Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. On the continuation of this program, Lantern from IRIB English Radio, we'll listen to an interesting story. The title of today's story is The Weight of Soil. There was a very clever and cunning landlord who owned lots of land in the whole village. He cunningly loaned a small amount of money when needy came to him for help. Taking the benefit of those who were not well-educated, he kept adding on interest to the principal amount. The amount for repayment of the loan would raise up so much that people couldn't pay back and end up surrendering their land to the landlord. Now his eyes were on a land owned by an old lady near his house. The landlord was not able to figure out how to lure her into giving up her land to him. He then bribed a government official in village and forged papers of ownership on his name. He, along with the government official, visited old lady and served her a notice to hand over the land to him. Old lady was shocked to know this and pleaded that she has been living here her whole life. She approached local court, but the landlord had bribed everyone and had presented forged ownership papers. Thus the court delivered the judgment in the landlord's favor, rejected old lady, then prepared to vacate the land while the landlord and his associates stood there waiting for her to leave. While leaving, old lady said, "Sir, the land here is where I played, grew up with my family, and this soil is very dear to me." She added further, "Allow me to carry a basket filled with this soil to keep with me. With that by my side, I will always have an aroma of this place till I die peacefully." The landlord smirked, thinking since he had gained ownership of her entire land without paying her, might as well let her have it a basket of soil so she can live quietly. He said, "Fine, you can fill up your basket." Old lady started filling up her basket with soil. She overfilled it and was struggling to lift the basket to carry over her head. She then told the landlord, "Sir, will you please lend a hand to put the basket over my head?" The landlord came forward to help and said, "Oh, you poor old lady, didn't you think before you overfilled this basket? You are struggling to lift this basket filled with soil, then how can you carry this with you?" With tears in her eyes, old lady said, "Oh, sir, this entire land was my own. Spent my whole life here. Yet I'm struggling to carry a single basket of soil from here while I am still breathing. I won't be able to carry it with me even when I die. You, sir, have so much of others' land. How will you carry it all with you?" The landlord stood stunned hearing this. He realized this mistake and fell on the old lady's feet asking for forgiveness. He requested her to live here happily and returned her land. And today's moral point: do not cheat. Don't be greedy. Do not take more than you need. Be content with what you have. Sometimes it's sufficient for a happy life.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then take some moral lessons out of them and make use of them in our daily life as followers of this great and perfect religion of Islam. Today, we want to talk about greed and how much it is reproached in our religion. The endeavor of a greedy person creates a chain of miseries for his society, for he intends to acquire his lust with unjust methods, including methods which may bring poverty to others. One who covets seizes the sources of wealth in order to acquire more for himself or herself, and consequently creating acute economical problems. The righteous religion of Islam, which conforms to man's nature, equally distributes between materialism and spirituality. It has therefore chosen a path for its followers that guarantees healthy spirits and bodies. Religious individuals possess wise and righteous spirit, for they understand divine facts. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam explained the afflictions and calamities which arise from greediness. He said, a greedy person faces seven acute problems. One, worrying, which harms his body and is disadvantageous to him. Two, depression, which is endless. Three, exhaustion, from which death is the only relief, and with that relief, the greed shall be more exhausted. Four, fear, which uselessly disturbs his life. Five, sadness, which uselessly disturbs the life again. Six, judgment, which does not save him from Allah's tortures unless Allah forgives him. And seven, punishment, from which there is no escape or avoidance. Let's go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
The Lantern.
Under the Light of Lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life. Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRIB English Radio. We are talking about greed, and we should say that it is necessary to keep in mind the disadvantages and the worldly and religious inconveniences of greed, and to remember that man will be interrogated about the legally gotten pleasures of this world, punished for the illegally gotten, and blamed for the suspicious. In order to treat greed, it is necessary to ponder over the virtues of satisfaction, contemplating the life accounts of the great personalities, such as prophets, their successes, and the saints, especially in the field of asceticism. It is also advisable to avoid looking enviously to the richer ones and those who enjoy false luxuries of this world, and to consider the less rich. And it is necessary to achieve living moderation, for it is the most important factor that contributes in alleviating the tension of greed. Okay, dear listeners, that's the time we've got for today's episode. Today we talked about greed and how dangerous it could be for the faith of a Muslim person. And we said that it leads into different calamities and difficulties. And we all ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us not falling into this trouble of being greedy. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Lantern. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss India and Iran dropping the arbitration clause for Chabahar Port and India's moon mission making significant development. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Iran and India drop foreign arbitration clause in Chabahar Port issue. And we shall also take a look at India's Chandrayaan 3 makes a historic landing on the moon.
In a bold stride, India and Iran have jointly decided to drop the foreign arbitration clause surrounding the Chabahar Port issue. This landmark decision clears the path for a substantial long-term agreement propelling the development of this strategic port. This manoeuvre, underpinned by mutual understanding, not only carries the potential to reshape bilateral ties, but also regional connectivity and boost investor confidence. The crucial development comes at a juncture when both nations are seeking to fortify their economic and strategic cooperation.
The recent decision to abandon the foreign arbitration clause in the Chabahar port marks a significant shift in the trajectory of India-Iran relations. Both the sides have conquered their disputes between users and operators at the Chabahar port will no longer be subjected to commercial arbitration in foreign courts. Instead, the mechanism of investment arbitration or alternative modes of dispute settlement will be pursued. This pragmatic approach will not only streamline the resolution process, but will also avoid the necessity for Iran to amend its constitution. Tehran and New Delhi have agreed that arbitration will be conducted under the auspices of UN Commission on International Trade Law, a favored choice of India over other trade arbitration mechanisms. According to experts, this move demonstrates the dedication of both the countries to create a conducive environment for fostering collaboration, paving the way in future for formal agreements and facilitating a seamless maritime route between Iran and India.
The Chabahar port, nestled on Iran's southeastern coast, has emerged as a pivotal corridor connecting India and Central Asia. Beyond its geographical significance, this port holds the promise of bolstering regional trade, enhancing connectivity, and also reshaping diplomatic dynamics. For India, it offers a direct maritime route to Afghanistan and beyond, bypassing Pakistan. Against this backdrop of strategic importance, the recent decision by India and Iran to drop the foreign arbitration clause ushers in a new chapter in Chabahar's development.
In a region where connectivity holds immense significance, this decision carves a new trajectory for India and Iran relations. As a testament to the significance of this decision, a team from India's Ministry of Port and Shipping is set to visit Iran in September. The team will be solidifying an agreement on the rules of engagement and the mode of arbitration. Experts say this diplomatic breakthrough has an array of cascading benefits. A long-term agreement would inject a sense of certainty into investment and development plans for the port. The newfound stability could further bolster the confidence of stakeholders in the viability of the Chabahar port's role as a strategic connectivity hub. Notably, the shift comes at a juncture when Iran has joined the BRICS expansion's first phase, amplifying its regional influence. Foreign affairs analysts say that diplomatic momentum has seen an increase as both sides are poised to expedite infrastructure collaboration, Chabahar Port being at the forefront.
Now to have more-